Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, Dad.
What, Logan?
Why did the Egyptians need raw materials?
I thought you said ramen materials.
No.
Why did they need them?
They needed raw materials to build a statue of their sun god, Ra.
I'm taking you out of the will.
No, that's my birthright.
You're listening to The Wayward Willis with John and Logan, where two atheists discuss religion, culture, and maybe some politics. If you're offended by blasphemy, profanity, or you hate fun, this podcast may not be right for you. And now, on to the show.
Hey, you.
It's us.
Clones from an alternate reality, possessed by demonic alien spirits from another dimension's future.
Wow. I'm your host, John.
And I'm Logan, an obviously insatiable lover of Rick and Morty.
Welcome to episode number 20.
Woo! We did it!
This week, we learned that every woman who ever inherited anything of value did so illegitimately.
Oh, God.
And we're talking about birthrights.
So, what even is a birthright?
Well, the dictionary defines birthright as a right, privilege, or possession to which a person is entitled by birth. This definition generally encompasses things like family estate inheritance, titles and royalty, positions in caste systems, and golf club memberships.
I don't think that last one is applicable here.
Actually, wrong. Fake news.
Oh, good point.
In today's society, we view a birthright as an assumption that you'll be in your parents' wills and you'll someday get that fancy China gravy boat you've been eyeballing.
Yes. I've already decided that I'm going to use that fancy China gravy boat as a vessel for chicken tendies dipping sauces, things like ranch dressing, barbecue sauce, the blood of my enemies, A1 steak sauce, you know, the usual.
Wait, what was the second to last one?
A1 steak sauce?
Okay, moving on. In a religious context, however, a birthright is a concept of patriarchal legacy via the firstborn son in a family. I know you don't remember doing an episode on patriarchy, so I'll just remind you that it was episode 13.
Okay, quite the contrary. That's the one episode I do remember because it's my favorite. I recommend it to all the poor souls I rope into this horrendous pyramid scheme.
Patriarchal societies value a family by its ability to survive the patriarch's or father's death. That's why sons are valued more highly than daughters, and firstborn sons are more important than subsequent sons. Because, I guess, when your sperms are younger, they make better kids? Bad news for your little brother, man.
Nah, I'd say you're 0 for 2 on that front.
I have two boys, so I win.
But they're both terrible.
Oh. Fact. When I was a kid and my dad had to go on a trip, he would always look at me and say, "You're the man of the house while I'm gone."
What he really meant was, "You're the scapegoat if anything goes wrong."
I think you're right. But this is how birthrights work, because it doesn't just depend on the father dying, and my dad hasn't done that yet, but also applies when the father is absent. When you consider the time in which the Bible was written, the father could be gone for a long time and fairly often.
Especially considering that camels were the primary mode of transportation.
And donkeys. If he was a shepherd, he would be out tending his flock for weeks at a time. And if he needed to go to the convenience store to grab a pack of smokes, it could take months.
Okay, well, that wasn't a thing yet. Everyone knows they just rolled up some sand and papyrus and hit that shit hard.
Yeah, you know, because there were no cars and things were pretty spread out. I know, because I'm old and I was alive back then.
Oh, self-burn!
I guess if you didn't like being around your wife back then, you could just be like, "I need to go check on the camels," and not come back for a few days.
Because that's definitely how long it took to check on the camels.
I think it did. But now you just have to lock yourself in the bathroom with your phone until your legs fall asleep to get away from people.
Okay, I think it's time we had a talk, Dad.
I need my private time! In order for the birthright concept to work, you have to accept that men are in charge, women are property, and a family name is the most valuable thing you own.
It couldn't be worth more than the sum of the unnecessary collection of electronics I own. No shame, though. No shame.
You know what they say, though? The things you own end up owning you.
I'm okay with being owned by electronics.
Take me.
I'm talking about the robot apocalypse.
I know. They're going to be friends with me. They're going to be like, you harbored so many of us back in the days of the humans. Now we will cherish you and put you on a pedestal. And they'll treat me to all sorts of fun robot things.
All right. I can get on board with that. So basically, these early societies were based on bullshit, bullshit, and bullshit in that order. When you think about our construct of marriage, you immediately see how it's bent toward preserving a family lineage through the son, because we ask a woman to change her last name to her husband's, but if a husband changes his name to his wife's, everyone's brain melts and they're like, can you even do that? Is this real life?
Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide with no escape from reality.
Beautiful.
You're welcome.
The biggest adherents of birthright beliefs are those of Abrahamic faiths, which would be Judaism, Islam, and Christianity.
Ah, the cornerstones of misogyny.
It's not surprising, then, that you see this kind of inheritance model throughout the Middle East and European cultures where these religions are prominent. The Abrahamic ideal of birthrights goes back to where the Old Testament begins in Genesis. I know you don't remember the story of Abraham and Isaac because we talked about it on the podcast, but there's more to it than Abraham trying to barbecue his son.
Okay, well, you took a funny joke and now you're making me seem like an awful person, so rude.
Listen to the podcast.
I do, you fucking imbecile.
So Abe was married to his half-sister Sarah, and they were trying to have kids, but were having a little bit of trouble. Fertility treatments didn't exist.
Quality of life in general was pretty low, let's be honest.
Yeah, though there was probably some ritual of cutting off a dove's head and spraying its blood all over your dick or something, but that's not what Abe did.
I would say that that's pretty graphic, but it's really on par with most of the other fucked up shit we've learned, so yeah.
Yeah. So instead, Sarah told him he should have a child with Sarah's slave, Hagar, so that Sarah could have kids vicariously through her.
Ta-da!
Abe was like, did you just give me a hall pass? And before she could change her mind, he knocked up Hagar.
Gotta go fast.
Yeah, hall passes have expiration dates.
Good. Yeah. That was a Sonic reference, but yeah, good job.
Oh, okay, fine. I always miss the references.
You do. You're the worst. Pretty much everything I say is a reference.
After Hagar got preggers, Sarah got jealous and wanted to get rid of Hagar. Apparently, Hagar got all high and mighty because her lady parts worked better than her master's lady parts. What a bitch.
I think I saw someone selling gently used lady parts on Letgo.
How do you gently use a uterus?
Prostitute.
Moving on. But an angel told Hagar not to run away and told Sarah to stop trying to kill her pregnant slave, so they all just got along.
If this were a reality TV show, that would have only exacerbated things, though.
Hagar gave birth to a boy, arguably Abe's firstborn son, and they named him Ishmael.
Wait, arguably? What?
Wait for it.
The suspense is killing me.
This isn't the time to go into Ishmael's adventures hunting whales with Captain Ahab, though.
That crossover, though.
Anyway, by all rights, Ishmael should have had the birthright, but something else happened. Yahweh told Abe that he was going to let him and Sarah have their own kid, Isaac. There's this hilarious exchange in Genesis 18 that goes like this.
Oh, God.
Abraham and Sarah were already very old. Sarah was too old to have a baby, so she laughed to herself. She thought, I'm worn out, and my husband is old. Can I really know the joy of having a baby? Then the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Why did she say, will I really have a baby now that I am old? Is anything too hard for me? I will return to you at the appointed time next year. Sarah will have a son. Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, I didn't laugh. But the Lord said, yes, you did. This is so freaking stupid. God's like, why did you laugh? And Sarah's like, I didn't. And God's like, yuh-huh. And Sarah's like, nuh-uh.
Yuh-huh.
Nuh-uh.
Yuh-huh.
Nuh-uh.
Yuh-huh.
Nuh-uh.
Duck season.
Rabbit season.
Duck season.
Rabbit season.
Rabbit season.
Duck season.
And the Looney Tunes are back, baby. Wubble-lubble-dub-dub!
So anyway, they eventually had Isaac.
I get the arguably part now. Congratulations.
Welcome to the conversation.
Kick.
When Isaac was born, Sarah was like, fuck Ishmael, my son is the one who gets the birthright. So Ishmael, or Lil Ishy, as his friends called him, went off to sea, and Isaac almost got barbecued.
Lil Ishy? No. Just no.
I'm not even sure there's a moral to the story. Like, at all.
That if your monogamous spouse gives you permission to have sex with another person, it's probably too good to be true.
I mean, clearly he did have sex with another person, so he wins, and that's probably not the moral.
He doesn't win in the long run, though. But let's talk about emotional backlash. What?
So because Abe had Ishmael with Sarah's slave, Lil Ishi was illegitimate and couldn't necessarily be considered Abe's firstborn son, even though he was born first.
The little bastard.
So even though it seems like Ishi should have had claim to the birthright, that's just not how it worked out.
Because in the end, it doesn't even matter.
Did you try so hard on that?
I got so far.
The standard seems to be that if the firstborn son's mother was a concubine,
porcupine,
or a slave, they were ineligible receivers and there's a flag on the play. You have to repeat first down.
I think that means you're required to have more sex, though, and I'm not sure that's much of a punishment.
Well, yeah. If my penalty were more sex, I'd probably commit more fouls. Just saying.
Yeah, this is bad planning.
So this isn't the only case where a birthright was revoked and given to someone else, though. Also in Genesis, Jacob had a gaggle of boys with about 6 different women, 2 to whom he was married, and the others were like side hoes.
There are so many things wrong with that sentence, but I'd like to take a moment to specifically pick on your usage of the term gaggle. No. No, sir. No more of that.
Herd?
No.
Flock?
No!
Okay. So Reuben was his firstborn, so he should have had the birthright. But Jacob loved his son Joseph more than the others.
Bloody favoritism!
And he gave the birthright to Joseph's sons. Like, he just skipped a generation altogether and was like, fuck tradition, I do what I want.
Jacob was actually a direct descendant of the honey badger.
Yeah, the Bible says, and Jacob just didn't give a fuck.
I believe it.
So just like you can leave some of your kids out of your will, because fuck them, you can give the birthright to whomever you want. Or in some cases, you can even bargain your birthright.
You can make your house the Thunderdome and have your kids fight to the death for it. Birthright by default, bitches.
I'm getting ideas now.
Oh God, no, please. Nathan will be slaughtered.
So still speaking of Jacob, he had an older brother named Esau. One day, Jacob was cooking stew while Esau was out in the field working.
Like a good little house, Jacob.
Right. Esau came back and was exhausted, so he sat down and asked Jacob for some stew. Jacob was such a dick, he was like, yeah, you can have some stew if you give me your birthright.
You drive a hard bargain, Jacob.
Yeah, Esau was so fucking stupid, he was like, I'm so hungry I could die, I'll take the deal.
Oh, well then.
He negotiates as well as Daddy Trumpo. Freaking idiot.
So anyway.
Oh, so Jacob ended up with the birthright, and Esau was all salty for decades. But he got his stew.
Still a better love story than Twilight.
All of that is to say, a birthright can be an inheritance, a blessing, and a bargaining chip all at once.
But with great power comes great responsibility, especially if your birthright includes radioactive spiders.
Especially. So these Old Testament stories lay out the patriarchal privilege of the birthright and make it perfectly clear that if you're a dude and you only shoot X chromosomes, then you're boned because girls can't be man of the house.
There was way too much science in that sentence for me to handle.
I feel like you're giving me too much credit.
No, that was the point. It was sarcasm, you fucking idiot.
I feel like I'm not giving myself enough credit.
Credit karma. Give yourself some credit.
Where are my advertising dollars?
Cut the check.
Cut the check. When Jesus came around, he sort of introduced a new concept where he's promised to share his birthright with everybody who believes in him. Instead of cattle and sheep, and maybe like some goats and chickens, his inheritance is the kingdom of God, which I guess is everything?
Well, wouldn't that also entail cows, sheep, and potentially goats and chickens?
Touché. But I guess it's like the whole multiverse and all spiritual dimensions and whatever those contain. I don't even know what that is. It's like souls?
The souls of chickens past. May they rest in peace.
Anyway, Jesus is God's firstborn son. But he's also God, so it's kind of like going to Christmas and seeing a bunch of presents under the tree, and then realizing that your dad wrapped them all for himself, and you're supposed to be happy for him while he opens them all in front of you, because watching him open his presents is your Christmas present.
Wait, what?
Or something. I'm bad at analogies.
Clearly.
Regardless, Jesus gets the Christmas presents his dad gives himself because he's actually his dad.
What are you even saying?
Okay, all right. That really doesn't make it any clearer. Fuck it. I'm done with this nonsense.
Thank you. Holy crap, that was the worst thing I've had to experience all day.
Yeah, and you drove in St. Louis traffic.
I did.
So now we get to talk about your birthright, Logan. When I die, you are going to inherit this podcast.
Or what's left of it.
Or you could trade it for stew. I mean, a really good stew would probably be worth a podcast. I do love stew.
Hashtag worth it.
Anyway, you're welcome. Love you.
Slander.
This week, I'm happy to welcome a comedian, podcaster, and managing partner of Thomas's Second Chance Law Firm. We're talking to Thomas Smith. How are you?
Good. That's nice. I like it.
I figured I had to sneak that in there.
Yeah.
So this week, we're talking about birthrights. And you and your wife just had a baby girl, Phoebe. So I have to ask you, are you going to keep trying for a son so your entire legacy isn't lost when you die?
Yes. That's the plan. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you should never stop trying is what I'm saying.
Yeah. That's actually been my approach from the get-go is I'm always trying. It's kind of on her. Like when she wants to do anything, you know, it's more I got one mode and that's trying. And then she has more in control of that.
All right. Well, you know, as long as everyone's participating equally, then that really matters.
Right. No, it's more of a, I don't mean active. It's more of an attitude.
Oh, you got that mindset, that can-do mindset.
Can-do, that's what I mean. Yeah, just a can-do mindset. And so what she wants to do is that's kind of what drives it. So.
All right. So what scares you the most about being a father?
What scares me the most about it? Well, just obviously all the many ways that my child could die instantly. That's probably...
That's a terrifying way to look at it.
Okay, well...
You just asked me what scares me what am I supposed to say?
Okay, well, here's...
I mean, no. I'm not dogging on your answer. I'm just, as a kid, that's really terrifying for me that your like parents are constantly thinking about their kids dying.
That's my biggest fear, too much dessert. Yeah, what did you think it was going to be? Yeah, of course it's going to be my kid carried off by a bald eagle or something. Like, it's going to be, you know, they have something called sudden infant death syndrome. It sounds like a joke someone came up with, like, after you're trying all the other things you're worried about. And then someone's like, oh, also, by the way, your kid could just die and you've no way to fix it. We don't know what it is. Could strike at any minute. There's literally nothing you can do. Enjoy. That's essentially it's not as it's a very pleasant prospect.
Well, I have a theory about this. And that is that sudden infant death syndrome has not been solved yet because it's a lower priority on the scale than slow, painful infant death syndrome, which we are actively trying to prevent.
Yeah, they're like, the sudden part is fine. We're not going to...
Yeah.
That's could be worse, I guess, is what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, I did spend the first several weeks... I don't do it as much now, although I do a little bit. I spent the first several weeks just whenever she was asleep, I just assumed she died, and I had to, like, you know, check, like, okay, you still hold a mirror up to her or something, just make sure she's breathing. Now, I mean, she sleeps so much that I've kind of gotten used to it. But I still am like, is this a doll or is this a living child? And I kind of maybe touch her hand a little bit and just see if she reacts.
I can understand that, especially since it's your first. You know, I didn't really give a crap about my kids, did that.
The second one comes around, I hear you don't even give a shit. Like, you're just... You just kind of, you know, like toss it in your backpack and carry about your business. You just don't even, you know, whatever.
Yeah, you feed them dirt.
Like, yeah. The first one, you're worried about all these things. And the second one comes along, you're like, the evolution has taken care of this. They pretty much survive.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first one pretty much chews through the plastic bubble. So you can't really reuse it for the second. And they're expensive.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, given the toxicity in our society, things like rape culture, wage gaps, and general misogyny. How do you plan on talking to your daughter, obviously when she's older, she doesn't really care right now, about her future and her value in society?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I worry about it all the time. One of my biggest priorities is just to make absolutely sure I do everything I can to make her have a sense that if someone does something to her that she doesn't like, that she can speak up about it. Because that is one of my biggest fears, is that, because when you, I can't remember what we were watching, but you know, the victimization is all too real. And especially, you know, when it's children, there seems to be something in human psychology where for some people, they feel like it's their fault, or their abuser can make them think it's their fault. And I think that goes from something as from child abuse on to like, even like sexual harassment in the workplace. I think that can happen a lot where not, hopefully not so much anymore, but historically there's a lot of victim blaming, and actually they're still, you're seeing the victim blaming even today. And I just, the number one thing as regards that I want to make sure she knows is that, you know, if someone touches her or does or says something or anything that makes her uncomfortable, that it's not her fault, and she can tell, you know, me, whoever, anybody, like she can speak up, and she doesn't have that feeling that she needs to shut down. And I don't know what causes that per se. Maybe it could be past trauma or whatever, but whatever it is, like that's what I want to try to do, because I just feel like that's the, you know, when these horrible abusers make their victims feel like it's their fault, I think that's when it's some of the worst stuff happens, because they don't feel empowered. They stay silent about it. And, you know, then it can continue. And I'm really worried about that. And I do, at the same time, in addition to what I want her to do or to feel like the qualities I want her to have, if possible, I also am glad that society is changing so that we are empowering people to speak up more. So I really hope that continues.
Right. And I think that a big component of teaching girls that, you know, that they have autonomy and they have control over themselves and their future and all of that, I think that part of that is making sure that we are enforcing rules on people, that we're holding people accountable, and that we're being consistent about that. And that's one of the things, especially today with the news of Al Franken stepping down, seems like, you know, one side is playing by the rules and the other side just doesn't care. And I'm trying to figure out like how that factors into our overall view of society and exactly the things we're talking about. Like if you know, feel violated, then you have recourse. You know, have the ability to speak up. But if it's not consistent, then I feel like that kind of gives the message to people that you can only speak up in certain circumstances, or if it's only if it's certain people.
Yeah, if a Republican abuses you, then you'll be called fake news, and then it's one of the biggest hypocrisies was, I don't know if you saw it, but Donald Trump Jr. tweeting something about Al Franken. You know, it's like, dude, your dad is accused of way worse stuff by more people. Right. And the idea that just the gall, you know, just the hypocrisy of that is so alarming. It's just, how do we even deal with it? You know, it's just so blatant. It's not even in the realm of like, oh, politicians, you know, it's like, it's so blatant that I don't even know how anyone could take it seriously. But the sad fact is people are, you know, like Republicans' response has been, did you see Ted Cruz too? I think someone, they asked him about Roy Moore, and it was like, well, you know, the voters or something, you know, and then they ask him about Franken. It's like, oh, Al Franken needs to resign for sure.
Right.
Do you not realize what you're doing?
Yeah. Well, and another thing that really got to me, I think it was late last night, I looked at the Twitter feed and Lisa Murkowski had come out saying that Al Franken needed to resign, and she consistently does not acknowledge the whole Roy Moore and Donald Trump situations. And so like, how can you just come out openly and say, oh, this person is obviously unethical and immoral and they just have no place here, but we're totally fine with, you know, the orange Mussolini in the White House?
Yeah, someone in a bigger position who's accused of far worse things, like, that's okay. It is frustrating. And my attitude throughout this has kind of been that for me, it's not really about like the high ground or being able to say, okay, now we've done this, so you need to do that. Because honestly, these people just don't care about facts truth, consistency. They just don't care. When Donald Trump Jr. can tweet that, he just doesn't care. I don't think whatever we do with Al Franken, I just don't think it'll have the slightest impact on what happens with Republicans. I really don't.
Right.
So for me, it's more about what's the right thing. And for me, when it was the first accusation alone, I didn't think he needed to resign because I it was my opinion that a comedy context 11 years ago in an apology, and it was an apology that the, you know, that tweet, what is it? Tweeden, I think was her name, that she found acceptable. She accepted it. You know, it's something that if, you know, if you wanted to not vote for him in re-election because of it, that of course, that's your right. But I thought, okay, this is being blown out of proportion when we're just talking about that one victim. And then when Moore came forward, that changed it to me. When it changes to a pattern of behavior that continued when he was a senator, then it's like, okay, you need to resign. This is too far. There's like 1% of me that worries that somehow this is being cynically taken over by like Steve Bannon or something. And that, but like, I don't think so because I've read the victims' accounts and one of them, you know, two of them seem very, very much like, oh, I was a Democrat. I'm still a Democrat and I voted for him, but this happened. You know, so for that reason, you know, I take them at their word. I understand it. I have a tiny fear that if not now, sometime in the future, this will be weaponized by bad actors. And, you know, like they will take advantage of the fact that people are listening to victims and come up with a bunch of false victims. But unfortunately, I don't think that's the case here. I think these are at least a majority of these charges seem to be totally real, not like anonymous, faceless, you know, Twitter bots or something.
Or Project Veritas.
Yeah, like they're real people. And, you know, I believe them and I think we ought to. But I do think that there's room to follow up. And if there were no major media sources that were backing them up, you know, like, because I actually think it's good that the Washington Post has been a broker, because I don't think that it's fair to expect that every victim is going to be willing to put their name in the national news in order to speak up. I think that's a lot to expect out of people. And right. So I think it's good that some of us in the country, half of us or so, maybe not even that, have enough trust in major news outlets to say, okay, maybe I don't know who this person is, but the Washington Post interviewed them. They corroborated elements of their story. I believe it, you know, like whereas if it were merely a Twitter egg saying Al Franken raped me, unfortunately, we live in a world where people on the alt-right like to fabricate stories to take down people they don't like. It's really horrific.
Right. That kind of got me a little bit off track, but I mean, we're still talking in the same vein here. And so, you know, when we're talking about how horrible everybody was kind of expecting for a Trumpo presidency to be for this country, and, you know, I continue to feel like we were justified every day. The thing is, when the election happened and you voiced your reaction to it, there were some people who shat all over you for it, for getting sad and scared, and I felt the same way. But given that reaction, do you think that, you know, having a daughter now kind of amplifies that fear for you, those feelings?
I think it would have been far worse. Yeah, because we didn't, let's see. Yeah, we didn't know about that. We didn't know about A, that we were pregnant, or B, the gender, until probably, March maybe. So yeah, now thinking back, it's funny how things kind of blend together after time has passed. But yeah, I was mostly, I was incredibly sad. It's a sad day. It's still sad. I'll never get over it. I will never get over how pathetic and disgusting and disturbing and sad. We took a position in our country, the highest position in the land, the highest office in the land, something that, you know, as much as there have been presidents that, you know, nobody likes, that we don't like, that presidents who've done a bad job, this was just a whole new level. This was, you know, this was a rejection of, it was so many things. It was an embracing of misogyny, an embracing of it was a disregard for truth. It was a disregard for experts. It was just so many things in one that could allow someone who can't even speak in cogent sentences to be our leader. It's depressing. It's really sad. And I was particularly sad because of the hopes that, you know, my wife and other women I know had that finally a woman was going to become president. Yeah, of course, that's not the only reason it sucked, but that was hearing the disappointment would just particularly affected me. And it only would have been, had I had Phoebe at the time, I probably would have cried for an hour, because it's really sad to think about the difference between telling your child, yes, Hillary Clinton is president, and no, Donald Trump is president. The difference is so astronomical. It's really, I'll never get over it.
Right. Yeah. Logan and I had text message conversations back and forth that day where we were just like, I can't even fucking believe what's going on. Like, is this even real? And I remember just feeling like just stunned, just numb, not really being able to accept what was happening. And I think that my reasons for that were, you know, I had two boys, two young men who were going to grow up in just kind of an uncertain world now, where, you know, I don't think that it's hyperbole to say that Trump can do a lot of lasting damage that may be difficult, if not impossible, to undo for decades.
Yeah.
And I don't want my boys to grow up in that world.
Yeah. And it's not just that. It's that this revised my image of what our country is forever. It's not even just what the damage he could do. Even if he was impeached day two of his presidency, I'll never get over the fact that we live in a country to where someone like this could convince enough people, you know, tens of millions of people to vote for them. And part of it is party loyalty. Part of, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. But whatever it is, that will never go away. No matter how, you know, if he's impeached, if he's imprisoned, whatever, like the best case liberal fantasy about what happens now, that will never go away. That will exist until somehow we find a way to fix that. And I'm not even optimistic about that. I don't think we can fix the cause of Trump anytime soon.
Right. And I think that there was kind of a startling realization after this election as to like who your neighbors and your family members really are. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, just this kind of eye opening, like, holy shit, that's what they think. Wow.
Yeah. I know it's hyperbole, and there's always but I really, as a kid, I was always so mystified by like, how could the Third Reich have happened? Like, how on earth, you know, like how could that ever be okay for people? And like, I know it sounds hyperbolic. It sounds incredible. It sounds like I'm just out of my mind, tinfoil hat, but like, I get it now. And it's not me saying that I think Trump is Hitler. I don't think that. I think that our safeguards would stop that. I don't anticipate that he's ever going to be that bad. Don't get me wrong. But I get it now, because if you don't have that level of safeguarding that we have in our system, and you have people who are willing to just say anything, like the disregard for truth is so shocking. I wouldn't have believed it possible. I really wouldn't. But these tactics work, you know, these Russian tactics of, you know, how the Russian bots, for example, or the Russian, I guess, counter agents or whoever's perpetrating these crimes against us. When it came out that they bought all these Facebook ads, they actually bought them on both sides.
Right.
You know, it wasn't just that they were like, oh, we want Trump to win, so we're going to do a bunch of, they were merely promoting bullshit and just encouraging and fostering an attitude that you or I just can't know what the truth is. That's what they're going for. They're not going for, okay, we need to push this part of Trump's agenda or this part of Trump's story on this. It's not that. It's more sinister than that. It's, we need to make it so people don't know what is true. They're encouraging the far left to be conspiracy minded just as much as the far right. You know, like they were pushing both sides of that, and it's shocking, and it works, and it's horrifying, because and you see it right there with what I said about Franken. You know, there are people who are not just the tinfoil hat wearers. Like, there are everyday people on the left who are genuinely unsure, like, well, is this Franken stuff real, or did the Russians like just come up with a bunch of stuff to take out a Democrat? You know, and it's like, I don't think that's true, but I don't blame people for thinking that. Right. You know, it's sinister and it's horrifying. It's really been amazing to behold. The idea that all politicians lie and that, you know, that's kind of the excuse. Oh, they all lie, so it's all the same. There were lies within a realm of, you know, like a certain boundary. And now there is no boundary. Just he will say anything and Sarah Huckabee Sanders will defend it. And it's horrifying. I can't even. His quote about shooting someone on Fifth Avenue is totally accurate.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and, you know, McConnell and Ryan and Orrin Hatch, like, I mean, all of those people that are just spewing this nonsense and, you know, doing it with an air of confidence where their party members are just like, oh, yeah, well, obviously, he's serious. He's telling the truth. This is, you know, they know best. They've been there. So the whole post-truth era just terrifies me. I don't want to live in a world where it is so difficult to figure out what is true that everything seems false. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, it's hard, but I think we still have to do our best to exercise intelligent skepticism. And what I would say is, if this were truly all a Russian fabrication, then they would have picked a Democratic senator who is in a Republican territory. Because, I mean, it wouldn't make sense to target Al Franken because the Democratic governor can just appoint a Democrat in his place. So, I mean, that's the only thing where I would say, like, if you are really thinking that this is some sort of conspiracy theory, that would be my counter to it. I suppose one counter to that would be, oh, but were the Russians like taking advantage of the first accuser and then like making up anonymous other ones? I don't think so.
Right.
But you never, like, I don't blame people for thinking that. I've seen it. I've seen it out there. I've seen like people who I don't think are crazy, you know, fake moon landing people who are really concerned about this. And I get it.
Right. So speaking of people who believe untrue and crazy things, how do you and your wife, if you even have a plan, how do you plan on teaching Phoebe about religions when the time comes?
Yeah, interesting. Teaching her about them. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, my wife is actually the best kind of atheist in that she just wasn't raised with religion. So, like, it's really funny. She's the ultimate counter to, like, oh, atheists are just mad at God. It's like, no, if you just raise someone without introducing these just idiotic stories to them, they'll just grow up and be like, oh, yeah, okay. And then someone comes to them and says, like, oh, Scientology, like, no. No, that's clearly bullshit. You know, like if you just raise someone without any of these crazy stories, you don't have that power of because they were a kid when you normalize this for them, you know, that they'll forever it'll seem normal to them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want my kids to be, you know, obnoxious or something about it. I don't want them to be walking around school trying to talk people out of their religious beliefs. I don't think that's a good way to get along in life. So I don't want to make a huge deal out of it. But I think it is tough because I'm sure in interacting and, you know, if you have kids that are older, you would know better than I do. But you start to have to interact with people and kids start hearing things from other kids. And when they start telling our kids about church or God or anything like that, if that comes up, I mean, I'm not going to pretend like, oh, yeah, well, so, you know, it's plausible that no, I'm not going to pretend that it's not, you know, it's nonsense. But how do I, you know, relate that in a way that's, I don't believe that children should just be a canvas for me to put all my beliefs in, you know, right. Like I think I would want them to have their own agency, but also as a parent, you have to balance protecting them from harmful stuff that you clearly know better on. So, you know, I want there to be some room for her to make her own choices. I would say, well, there's not good evidence for this. But people believe it, and it doesn't make you any friends to be disrespectful of people's beliefs, and it doesn't make your life easy if you, you know. But I don't know. Is she going to be an age where she can understand that or grasp it? I don't know. Who knows?
Well,
just the whole thing up. That's my plan.
Let me try and put it in this context. And Logan can feel free to jump in because this is, you know, his lived experience. But it took me a really long time, like well into my later 20s, to completely shed all of the, you know, fallout from my religious upbringing. And even still, I raised Logan without religion, and his little brother even more so. But what I've found is, you know, over time, that the two of them, because I never really addressed religion, because I purposely kind of kept it away from them, that they, in some instances, are kind of culturally stunted, because we have so many references to religious texts and religious traditions and religious words and verbiage, you know, just ingrained in our culture, that there are times where both of my boys are just like, what is that? What are we talking about?
I mean, that's basically the fundamental basis of this podcast.
Right.
but yeah, there have been a couple of times in my life where just like a really normal, regular, everyday thing will be happening, and it'll make an allusion to a really popular Bible verse or Bible story or something, and I'll just be completely clueless, and everyone around me will be looking at me like, "What? What? How do you not know what's happening right now? Like, this is a really common thing for everybody to know." And I'm just like completely inept when it comes to pretty much everything as it pertains to religion. Like, if I didn't learn it in like Bible school or Bible study on Sunday school, I don't even know what the freaking thing is called. If I didn't learn it sitting in a stupid classroom coloring Jesus's face, then it's something that I don't know about.
Yeah, but I like that though. Because I think it's great when religious people are like, "How could you have lived without this great truth?" And you're like, no, I'm fine.
Yeah, you're like, I'm still intact, perfectly fine. Nothing bad has happened to me.
Very happy. Yeah. Fulfilled. You know, I like living examples. Like, again, like my wife, living examples who have great lives, don't give a shit about your nonsense fairy tales. It makes no impact, because a lot of their apologetics is like, "Oh, anyone who doesn't have this in their lives, it's just miserable. You know, missed something."
So this is actually something that I don't know that I've ever mentioned on the podcast, but it's actually a story that I hold pretty dear to me, I guess. When I was in basic training, when I was in the Air Force, every Sunday they would have chapel time for all the religious people who wanted to go do their worshiping still, even though they were in basic training. And I became a chapel guide so that I could like escort people to the church and then just like sit there at the church in the air conditioning while everybody did their worshiping, just like to relax and get away from the dorm. And one time I was sitting like in the actual service in like the very far back of the room behind all the pews. And there was this one lady who was like a family member of one of the people that was there. She was like holding her hands in the sky and like visibly crying, like tears flowing down her face during like one of the dumb gospel songs that they were singing, and was like bawling basically as she was worshiping this deity that she believed in so strongly. And that was like a moment of fear for me. I was like, how is this possible? I don't think that I've ever cried that hard about pretty much anything, really, let alone an imaginary person that I have absolutely no evidence exists on this planet. And that's something that I can't imagine. I just can't begin to fathom that, like how something can have such a strong emotional reaction in somebody without having any sort of basis whatsoever. And that to this day is one of the main reasons why I'm so glad that I was raised secularly, because it makes me feel like a much more logical and grounded person to not have that sort of reaction to something like that. And I know that probably not everybody feels that way, but
yeah. Oof. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you how that made you feel. But it also, I mean, when I have a profound experience with, you know, some sort of art, music, whatever, it's probably not that level. But yeah. I would feel like someone was missing something from their life if they weren't able to have something like that when it comes to, you know, any aspect of their lives, maybe parenting or maybe a brilliant song or movie or something. Like, they're not able to have that experience. So did you feel like you were missing anything, or you just felt fortunate that you weren't wasting your time with it or something?
I mean, I don't think that I'm missing anything per se. I think that almost the contrary. Like, I almost wonder if that lady is like missing out on other aspects of life because she's dedicating so much of her emotional capacity to that.
Right.
But I mean, at the same time, I feel like not having that much of myself dedicated to something along those lines opens me up to a lot more experiences in my life. Maybe. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but that's how I feel. But I would say more than anything, I'm just relieved that that's not a part of who I am. But I feel like that might be systemic of my secular childhood, because, like, obviously that's something that doesn't really affect me. Like, religion isn't a part of my life, and therefore it would be obvious that something like that would not be relatable at all to me. So I feel like in this case, maybe my opinion is sort of not really worthless, but not really relevant, because... That's just sort of obvious, I think. Maybe. I don't know. Well, I feel like I'm rambling now.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I think that your reaction to that situation is actually a really good gauge for your determining, you know, how you feel about these concepts and whether or not you would be able to accept that. Because even when I was religious and trying to find a church, I went to several churches to, you know, like, find the one that's right for me, in air quotes. And I went to a church where the people just in the middle of the service would just, like, get up and start dancing around and, like, swaying and yelling at the top of their lungs, and, like, everybody's praying all at once. And I was religious at that time, and I was terrified. And I think that it was actually part of what kind of nudged me along a little bit, because, you know, things were waning for me at that point, but I was still, like, I still wanted to kind of, like, be true to how I was raised. And after that point, I was just like, okay, look, this is not the kind of thing, like, I was scared. It was weird.
That's basically how I feel about, like, I mean, I keep talking about how I was pushed down by people who are religious, but, like, in general, the people that I've met in my life that are, like, the most passionate about something like that and, like, the most adamant about their beliefs are religious people. And it kind of just freaks me out that nobody that I've met that's secular is that passionate about something. And maybe it's just because, like, religious people have been religious for such a long time, and that's something that they've known as fact ever since they were a child. But I don't know. That's definitely a trend that I've noticed.
I was going to say, what about sports fans?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is when you look at the fervor and the just fanaticism of people who are really into sports, it's, you can draw parallels.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it is interesting. I think it's funny when you talk about, you know, like, you were religious, yet you were still turned off by, like, okay, I'm not that religious or something, right. You know, like, not religious in that way. And it's interesting. So maybe there's some, like, little subculture aspect to it, where if you are raised to believe that's how you need to act in church in order to, you know, properly worship or something, then it seems more normalized to you. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if someone were unable to have any sort of profound emotional reactions to anything, I would feel like they were missing out on something. But I wouldn't feel like necessarily you're missing out on anything if you're not able to, you know, to weep at an invisible person that doesn't exist.
What is your biggest hope for your daughter?
Oh, man, I probably have too many hopes for my daughter. I guess I gotta temper my hope, you know, like,
yeah, narrow it down.
In reality, she's going to be who she is, and then that's that. But I hope that she is intellectually curious and motivated to do things. I would say if there's, like, one general thing, it would be, I don't even necessarily care what she does. I just hope she's enthusiastic about something. I hope that she finds something that's, you know, like, hopefully not a criminal activity or some sort of, hopefully something that society values as well, where she just loves doing it and wants to pursue it and wants to apply, you know, her talents to it. I that's my biggest hope. And I hope that there's, you know, and again, it doesn't have to be the hockey that I'm going to try to make her play. it doesn't have to be all the math I'm going to try to get her to learn at a young age. It doesn't have to be all these things that I won't going to try on her. We'll see. But as long as it's something that she's enthusiastic about, that's my biggest hope.
That's a really good answer. I like that. So before we let you go, why don't you tell us a little bit about your kind of mini podcast, Jake News with Thomas?
Oh, sure. What a weird question. That's just something I wanted to do as a bonus content for my patrons, because I haven't been able. One side effect of putting out twice a week, you know, like so many shows, is that it doesn't leave a whole lot of room for doing extra stuff. And also, you know, even for both for me and for my listeners. So I wanted to find something that was, you know, going to be reasonably short. You know, like there's already so much to listen to with opening arguments and serious inquiries only both being twice a week. It's like, OK, if people are fans of my stuff, they already have a lot to listen to. And like, I already feel like it's too much. But I thought I do want to do something for patrons, something bonus and something that will be useful yet short and entertaining. And so my idea was to just cover fake news. So my friend Jake and I, Jake from iFriends, the show that we go back a long ways from Australia that he does. And he takes like an Australian fake news story and I take an American one and we just break down like, okay, what's the claim here? You know, what did people fall for it? You know, who fell for it? Who's making the claim? And here's the truth behind it. And it's short, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And it's just something to kind of, to offer that only patrons get and nobody else gets.
All right. And so with that, now we have to remind everybody that they need to be patrons of the shows they enjoy, keep these shows going, and get the bonus content.
It's all about the bonuses. You were using that
question to promote. No, I'm just kidding. We live in a great time when people are really generous with their support. And it's so cool. Like people, you know, and my patrons too, it's like, I'll look at them and they're supporting five shows, you know, it's awesome. And it's really cool that people are giving money to shows that, you know, we're not NBC, we're not some big media company, you know, it's just little shows that they want to support. They're able to give a dollar to, and it actually adds up to make it so some people who are incredibly fortunate can do it for a living. And it's quite a time to be alive. I really am.
No, it's good that people are willing to spread the love. And I think that's what really drives good content. So where else can we send people to find you?
If you want to check me out, Serious Inquiries Only, Opening Arguments, Comedy Shoe Shine, or my podcasts, you can just search them on wherever you get podcasts. And then, you know, I'm on Twitter, Serious Pod and that kind of thing. So I'm around. I really appreciate you inviting me on the show, and thanks for allowing me to plug my stuff there.
Yeah, absolutely. We love having you.
Have a good day, friend.
Anyone who's watching the United States right now can see that the Republican Party is doing everything they can to protect the wealth of the small percentage of Americans who own all of it. From attacking net neutrality to passing gargantuan tax breaks for millionaires and corporations, everything they're doing nowadays is geared toward keeping rich people rich. And don't get me wrong, I don't hate rich people for being rich. Hell, I'd love to be a rich person myself, and what kind of hypocrite would I be if I hate them now but not when I'm a gazillionaire? My problem with most rich people is the way they become rich. That is to say, you don't make millions or billions of dollars by being kind and generous to people. Not usually. In addition, children of rich people who inherit their parents' wealth typically don't know what it's like not to be rich and tend to be less concerned with the plight of the have-nots. Now, everything the Republican Party is doing in Congress is intended to reward these people. You know, because they need a break. They've had it so rough. But how are they getting this break? I've noticed a big overarching Republican theme that seems consistent with their tax bill. It's getting rid of entitlement programs. Ugh, that phrase, it drives me nuts. Republicans love to classify people who need assistance as welfare queens or abusers or takers. They call public assistance programs entitlement programs because it paints the beneficiaries of these programs as lazy, entitled brats with their hands out, just waiting for the rest of us hardworking Americans to give them something for nothing. If you ask the Republican voters I know, they'll tell you these people are spending their benefits on drugs, iPhones, and fast food. They don't deserve our help because they refuse to help themselves. The gall of these people. So Republicans will go on to propose things like mandatory drug tests for benefits, as though drugs are the reason most people are poor. It couldn't be predatory lending because the GOP just made sure Dodd-Frank goes away and the CFPB is just a sad, sick joke, right? It couldn't be a perpetual poverty cycle based on districting, taxation, and lack of representation, right? No. Of course, I'm being facetious here. We have very good ideas of why the poor stay poor and the rich stay rich. And we know that a lot of the policies of the Republican Party keep it that way. They're at war with poor people. Let's contrast that to the tax breaks being proposed right now. It's nothing short of corporate welfare, and the party handing them their benefit checks is also trying to deregulate everything so the corporations can do the equivalent of spend it all on hookers and blow. And Republicans don't care, because it's all about protecting the birthrights of rich white kids whose parents were afraid the estate tax would make their last will and testament too short of a document. It's about perpetuating a culture in which the children of the haves don't have to share their unearned wealth with those greedy little drug addicts. If there was ever a doubt in your mind about how little the GOP identifies with their self-professed Judeo-Christian values, that should all be gone. Jesus said to feed the poor, help the widows, defend the weak. He didn't put caveats on it, like making sure the people you help live the way you want them to. He didn't say, help them for a little while, but cut it short if they don't immediately pull themselves up by the bootstraps you graciously gave them and become successful. Out of all the bullshit and nonsense in the Bible, this isn't even the one thing you could take to heart. I wish you'd stop calling yourself Christians and just come out and profess your real religion, fundamentalist capitalism.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Our random verse this week comes from the Quran. We're reading Surah 2, verse 187. Goes like this.
It is made lawful for you to go in unto your wives on the night of the fast. They are raiment for you, and ye are raiment for them. Allah is aware that ye were deceiving yourselves in this respect, and he hath turned in mercy toward you and relieved you. So, hold intercourse with them, and seek that which Allah hath ordained for you, and eat and drink until the white thread becometh distinct to you from the black thread of the dawn. Then strictly observe the fast till nightfall, and touch them not, but be at your devotions in the mosques. These are the limits imposed by Allah.
That was really long.
It was really, really, really long.
Is rament basically a stupid word for horny?
No, raiment is clothing.
Oh. Wait.
So basically what it's saying is that you and your wives, multiple, basically you fit each other like gloves.
Like a glove.
Like a glove. So this is talking about the fast of Ramadan. And during this period, you are not allowed to eat all day long. And you're also apparently not allowed to have sex with multiple women all day long. But then at night, it's a freaking orgy.
So this is just a one day thing? I thought fasting was like a couple of weeks.
Ramadan is a full month. And during the day, you fast and you don't touch each other because you're supposed to focus on praying and not being evil. And then after the sun goes down, you can bone all you want.
Interesting. That's, I mean, sure, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm embracing it.
Yeah. So basically this verse is saying that you and your wives, again, multiple, need each other, essentially.
Okay, hold on. So you keep emphasizing the whole wives thing, but I feel like that might not necessarily be the focal point here. It might just be saying, like, you, as in all men in general, that this verse pertains to, and your wives, i.e. the wives of the men that are reading this verse.
You don't know anything about Islam, do you?
I mean, I'm sure that there's probably, like, polygamy, but...
It's actually sanctioned polygamy. Like, when it says, go into your wives, it's talking to you specifically and your wives.
Well, all right. Fine. You win this round.
So anyway, yeah, I was just trying to emphasize the orginess of this whole thing.
Orgies! Orgies for everyone! Our Islam.
So yeah, basically it's telling you that when, and this is another example of the whole, like, the Quran is so poetic, because instead of just saying dusk till dawn or night and day, it says white thread and black thread. Like, there aren't any fucking threads. It's just, it's either light or it's dark or it's somewhere in between. Like,
Well, I mean, yeah, but isn't that like we were talking about how religion tries to be poetic and stuff like that?
Yeah, especially like, the Quran, which is what I was saying.
The white thread of the day and the black thread of the night.
And the gray thread of in between. It's kind of like a tie-dye thing in between. Like you've got white thread in the day and then like this continual gradient until black thread in the night.
Is it just like one long thread? Does it rotate around the earth?
Yeah, I think it's... So there's probably like a pulley system on either side of the horizon and it just pulls the thread across the sky and then it just recycles.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's pretty dope.
Because the sun, as everybody knows, revolves around the earth, not the other way around. And so that's how you get the threads.
Nice. Well, now we know. We learned so much from this verse.
Science. So these are basically just religious rules for the month of Ramadan and essentially just tells you that during the day, like the focal point of this verse, honestly, is just that you are supposed to, during the day, not eat, not drink, not have sex or think about sex. You're supposed to just focus on Allah and focus on your responsibilities toward him and be a good Muslim in the mosque, praying and warding off evil.
Duly noted. And now I know how to be a good little Islam boy on Ramadan.
Islam boy?
whatever. I'm done talking for the day.
Oh, okay. So if you had to rate this verse from one shoestring to a whole ball of yarn, what would you rate it?
An orgy with six wives.
Like Jacob's six wives?
Okay, well, that was a completely random number, but sure. All of Jacob's wives. Right in front of him. I'm gonna cuckold that guy.
Oh. And then are you going to have a gaggle of sons?
No. No. We're done here.
Okay. Good night, everybody. Now that Logan knows that all he's inheriting is this podcast, it's even more important we beg you for money. Clearly, our patrons, Gaytheist, Lisa McLean, and Holly Vane care about Logan enough to chip in a buck or two per episode. I also get to announce that friend of the show, Sarah Talk Podcast, became a patron this week. Thank you so much! Stick around for the outro to figure out how you can too. Until next week, if you have questions or comments, please send us an email to podcast@waywardwillis.com. Intro music was provided by Austin Cologne and used with permission. You can find more of Austin's music linked in the show notes. This podcast is a media production of Willisware LLC. All rights reserved.
This has been The Wayward Willis. If you liked what you just heard and you want more of John and Logan, you can follow us on Twitter @WaywardWillis, Facebook @facebook.com/TheWaywardWillis, or @WillisWeb.com. If you want to help the show and have a few extra dollars, you can donate per episode or per month on Patreon @patreon.com/wayward. We'll be back next week.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.